Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Oh, good morning, and what a wonderful day. We're so glad you're here. I'm Lynette, another gorgeous day here in the Pacific Northwest, and back to cool
weather. If your definition of gorgeous is gray and overcast.
That's okay.
At least it's not pouring rain, the wind isn't blowing us stuff sideways.
So, yeah. I heard you had a bit of that. I was down in Florida
a few days,
and it was hot, so I was happy when that cool air hit me this morning.
Well, you see, that's the difference. I've been here.
Yes.
So I didn't get to go to Florida this time.
Not this time.
Anyway, we are all here today.
Well, we are.
All of us, not Samira.
We decided to let her have a weekend off.
Yeah, she's out of town enjoying herself. So
yes, doing something
fun,
I'm sure.
It's just me today.
That's okay.
Oh, well, me and all of you out there.
So that's right.
You give us a call and we'll chat about almost anything you want to talk about.
That's right. Anything age related, new symptoms you're dealing with, maybe even something your spouse is going through. You don't quite understand. Mm-hmm. You got that diagnosis and then got kicked out the door and you're like, okay, what just happened? Dr. Mixon, can you tell me more?
We'll try.
We will try. 800-465-8770. Those phone lines are wide open right now, and you can call in 800-465-8770. Now, I've been out of the state for a week, Dr.
Yes,
Mixon. And
I've been in state for
You have been in state. And may I say, can I do a little push here for your Go Factor, which is something that you have developed, and I love it. And when we were in Florida, my husband was like, oh, I have no energy. I'm so tired. And, you know, the heat was just sacking everything. He's like, I need a Coke or a Mountain Dew. I'm like, no, you don't. Try some of these. And I gave him some Go Factor, and boom, he noticed it right away and felt good and perked right up.
No, and I use it a lot when I travel and cross a lot of time zones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sluggish feeling you get when you're 3 to 10 hours off.
Yes, and you're like, oh.
Biological clock, yeah. So, and of course, at my size, I take all three. And, I get perky as can be.
Yes, and then we continued on, and it was wonderful. We did that a few times. So if you are a Relief Factor fan, and I know a lot of you are out there, I know I am, you've got a few more things added to the list, so check them out. Go Factor is one of them, and that will give you the energy you need without all the crud of those monster drinks or the 5-hour energy or whatever they
you
are.
Know,
right?
We've got the Relief Factor, which has been doing well for years.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Go Factor, mm-hmm. Z Factor, Zen Factor.
Yes. Whatever you're needing, we've got it.
In about 2 months, we'll be adding Think Factor.
Okay.
For cognition.
Okay.
You know.
Good.
Yep. And then sometime, probably in the late fall, we'll probably be adding Smart Kid.
Ooh.
So something like that. To improve cognition in elementary and high school age kids.
Okay, Smart Kid. That's good for them. Oh, so wonderful. Okay, now, Dr. Mixon, it is only you, but I know that you read those medical journals every single day. You've gathered information, perhaps you've got an update for us on what's going on in the medical world.
You know, there's an awful lot going on in the medical world. Some of it even good, but most of the time I'm concentrating on things related to aging and how to keep our brains and bodies functioning well. And there's a whole lot of interesting things that I'm not sure are ready for prime time.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, I belong to something they call the Foresight Institute, which is a group of scientists and doctors from around the planet that are looking for the newest, the best, trying to innovate, which is really a fascinating group of people.
I bet.
And, one of my wish lists this year was that I could get free in mid-July to go to Bavaria. There is a Foresight Institute weekend there in a castle in Bavaria.
Oh. Yeah, I hope you said yes, Dr. Mixon, you got to do this.
Well, I'm
working on it?
Looking at it pretty hard.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just a matter of got so many things going on here in the States. And, you know, if I'm going to fly to Germany.
You might want to stay more than just a weekend.
Yeah. It's a three-day meeting, but you don't want to fly in the night before, you know, and be jet-lagged all through the meeting. By the time you finish your jet lag,
you come back.
Yeah. So,
no.
So as a practical matter, I've got to free up a whole week or so that I can de-jet lag before the meeting starts and be awake and alert during the meeting, you know, that sort of thing. So
very good.
We'll see.
Okay. But, okay. And you're doing things here in the States too. You are always so busy. You always have something new that you're working on.
Well, yeah, we got some things going on that we'll be bringing out here in about 2 months. I've got a product in manufacturing right now that we're calling Think Factor.
Think Factor.
Yeah. Well, it's really kind of fascinating. One of the problems of aging, and in this case, aging starts in your 30s. We start decreasing the production of acetylcholine in our brains. And that's the primary neurotransmitter that allows us, you know, our brain cells to communicate with each other. They fire with acetylcholine. And our acetylcholine levels in our brain start to drop. The other problem is that the membrane of the nerves in our brain are just less and less sensitive, and they take more to stimulate them. So what we've done is found two different approaches to increasing the declining cognition in people over 40. And that is not a treatment for dementia.
Okay.
That's a pathological.
That's dementia. Something different.
But normal cognitive decline. You know, it's kind of fascinating. Our processing speed is fastest when we're about 17 or 18 years old.
Wow.
We think very quickly. Not very maturely.
Yeah, I was going to say it's
impulse control, but everything is moving fast.
Yes. Yes.
And then about 30, we hit maturity, but our processing speed is actually starting to slow already. And our verbal memory, our ability to handle complex tasks starts to decline. And by 40, that is clearly measurable in the vast majority of people, that our ability to handle complex executive actions is going downhill. Trade-off is we start developing experience. And our memory of our life experiences tends to be quite good till quite late in life.
Okay.
So we are slowing the speed of processing. Our memory is getting worse every year from about 35 or 40 on. And yet we are able to substitute experience for problem solving. So we say, okay, last time something similar to this happened, here's what I did. It worked out well or it didn't work out well. It lets you know, and you start developing the experience of life to substitute for the ability to rapidly solve problems. So it is a trade-off.
Okay.
But my goal is to raise that cognitive speed and memory processing and executive function back to where it used to be when you were younger. Because then you've got both the experience to draw on as well as the capacity to rapidly evaluate and solve problems.
Wow.
And that's what Think Factor is all about.
Ooh, that's good. That's going to be a good one, Dr. Mixon.
So we raise the acetylcholine in our brain. We stabilize those membranes so that they actually function and fire more appropriately. And my goal is to give people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s the processing power that they had 20, 30 years earlier in addition to their experience. I think that's going to be a good product.
I think so. That sounds great. Yep. Acetylcholine, and is that found in anything that we would eat naturally?
No, it's something we produce.
We produce it. We just produce less of it as we age.
Right, and so what we do is we provide you with the metabolic precursors for the acetylcholine so that your body then starts making more. You process the stuff we give you into the acetylcholine.
Right.
Along with the lutein and zeaxanthin, which are the membrane enhancers. So it's actually three things in one pill.
That's good.
So
Think Factor coming to a relief factor store near you.
Right, coming to our website in about July, maybe.
Okay.
August at the latest.
All right. Into summer. Okay. That sounds good. All right. Dr. Mixon, are you ready? We've got some callers anxious to talk to you on the line this morning.
Sure. Put them on. Let's see
All
what's going
right.
on.
All right. Let's head to Chehalis right now. We have Joe on the line. Joe, you are caller number one. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I have a question, doctor, about, I've got a sister that just got diagnosed with breast cancer. And according to the doctors, I went to the meeting, it's one of the best ones, I guess, if you have breast cancer, you can have.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a good prognosis, I understand. But they're going to put her on some kind of hormone blocker. And this girl suffers anxiety and depression. And how's that putting her on a hormone blocker, how's that going to affect her psyche?
It's going to get worse.
Hmm.
Because they're going to block down her estradiol and her testosterone production to almost zero. And so she's going to become far more susceptible to stress reactions, anxiety, depression. Those are just givens. Yeah, it's a side effect.
Doctor, she's on Xanax now and antidepressants.
Xanax and depression are a bad combination anyway, because Xanax is a depressant. It's an anti-anxiety agent, but it works in part by triggering depressive disorders. So
I've been trying to convince her to get off this stuff, but so this is just going to get worse. Is there anything they can give her to help that whole situation? Because they know she's on Xanax and antidepressants.
But you got to realize the oncologist's job is to protect her against the breast cancer. The rest of her brain and body are outside of his purview. He's only focused on breast cancer. And all the other bad effects are just extraneous, because that's his one and only focus in life is breast cancer. That's the problem with oncology, or with virtually essentially any subspecialty. That is one of the biggest problems in modern medicine. Cardiologists are only worried about your heart. Urologists are only worried about the urogenital system. And so each specialty focuses on its direct sequela and pretty much ignores the rest of the body. So the things we do for breast cancer have widespread effects outside of that cancer. And, they need to be addressed. It would help if you knew what type of cancer and the stage of the cancer. And from what you're telling me, I'm guessing that it's probably an in situ lesion of some sort.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's very, very, very tiny. She caught it. The doctors are just like, wow, you caught this just in time. So they're just getting on this, and they're going to have her in surgery within a week it's going to be a good thing, complete deal.
Okay. So they don't have a biopsy report yet. They don't really know what they're dealing with.
They do.
So they biopsied it first, and then they're going to go do surgery? So what was the pathology report on the biopsy?
Oh, I'm sorry. I just don't have. I was just there for the meeting. They said this is the best cancer, and I kind of read it. It was like it's the smallest little, just very, very, very tiny. They kept explaining that very, very tiny, and they're going to go in there and they're going to take that out. And they're going to put blue dye in her, and they might have to take out some nodes. This kind of deal.
Okay. Oh. Well, see, I'm hearing a couple of almost contradictory things. If it is an intraductal carcinoma in situ, which is the least aggressive, the most benign thing that we call cancer, and in fact, it is so benign that many physicians don't believe we should even really call it a cancer, because once you say cancer, everything ramps up, and the chances of people dying from a intraductal carcinoma in situ are extremely low, and the recovery rate is extremely high. So, but if they're going to be doing surgery and taking out nodes and so on, that tells me that it's probably something more than that, more of a lobar sort of issue instead of intraductal. So, you know, without really knowing the pathological diagnosis, whatever I say is almost certainly going to be wrong, because I don't know what kind of lesion I'm talking about. And the approach to the different lesions are widely different.
I understand. I was really concerned when I heard about the hormone blocker, how that was going to work out for her.
Let's take a quick break. When we get back, I'm going to talk a little bit about an alternative approach to the relatively benign cancers.
All right. Joe, you stay right there. We're going to talk more about this subject of breast cancer, what to do, and as she's going through this process. And Eileen and John, we're going to get to your questions as well. Stay right there. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back. Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette here, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon. And we would love to talk with you about your health concerns and questions. Here's that number to get through, 800-465-8770. Dr. Mixon talking with Joe. Sister has breast cancer. What are those options? We've been talking about that.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about where breast cancer comes from, okay? There are basically two forms of breast cancer that we have identified clearly. One is a genetically triggered, BRAC 1 and 2. These are women with a genetic propensity for breast cancer. 99% of those women will get breast cancer at some point in their life. I mean, it's a terrible gene to be carrying.
And I know people can test for that now, and their daughters can test.
That's right, yes.
To find out if they
are. Well, and men can have the mutation,
that's
too.
That's true, yes.
Okay, and they get an especially aggressive form of prostate cancer. So if, you know, there are the genetic cancers, and the genetically triggered cancers require very aggressive therapies. In fact, many of the women are undergoing bilateral mastectomies and losing their ovaries and so on, because they're just at super high risk of cancers. And then there's the more run-of-the-mill common cancers that usually occur in 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s and up. And these are essentially hormone deficiency triggered cancers. When women have their highest levels of testosterone and estradiol, they have their lowest risk of cancers. And as our hormone levels decline, our cancer risk starts going up. And the lower our hormone levels, the higher our cancer risk. Mm. And it's almost as though at some point that the breast, like the prostate, requires that hormone stimulation. And when it starts losing it, it starts trying to figure out what's going on. And it undergoes a mutation in which it now makes its own estrogens and its own growth factors. And the result is now you have an immortalized cell that produces its own hormones. And that is the cancer. That's what makes it a malignancy. It is immortalized. It won't die. It doesn't die and turn over cells as quickly as it should, and it reproduces very quickly. And it's producing all of its own growth and hormone factors. So what we really want to do is turn off the production of those growth factors and hormones within the tumor. But we don't know how to do that. We don't have a medication that only turns it off in the tumor. So what we end up doing is we give people medications that turn off the hormone production in their entire body in order to try and turn it off just in the tumor. We turn it off everywhere. And that's not a healthy thing to do, because our brains need the hormones. Our lungs need it. Our hearts need it. Our bones need it. Our kidneys need it. Our guts need it. Our skin needs it. We need these hormones all over. When we turn them off, we put people on an accelerated aging program. And depression, fatigue, anxiety, muddled thinking, low energy, osteoporosis, heart disease, kidney failure, strokes, all of these things increase when we turn off a woman's hormones. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that, you know, we want to do lightly. On the other hand, if she's got a tumor that is an aggressive tumor with a high risk of killing her, well, then that trade-off may be worthwhile.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, that's the reality. Dr. Mixon's first rule of medicine, anything strong enough to help is strong enough to hurt. And in this case, abolishing a human being's ability to make all those steroid hormones we depend on can both save your life and make your life not worth living. So, you know, it's a problem, especially for people that have pre-existing anxiety and depressions. So what you want to make sure... What you want to make sure of is that the tumor is dangerous enough to justify that rather dramatic intervention.
Okay.
And
yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah. So,
a lot to take in.
Yeah.
I knew you'd know all about that hormone thing.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where I spend most of my life. But there, you know, there is a third way for some people, and that is one that both Dr. Glazier in Ohio and Dr. Donovitz in Georgia have talked about, and that is giving the women two things at the same time, giving them an implant that raises their testosterone level, because testosterone is the drug that basically decreases stress and anxiety, and it's an potent antidepressant. Testosterone makes women and men self-confident, stress-tolerant, able to handle just about anything that comes along, and it decreases depression dramatically in both men and women. But you couple that with aromatase blocker, an aromatase inhibitor, and so you give them both of those so that the tumor can't take the testosterone and turn it into estrogen. And so,
wow.
Yeah, so you use a breast implants that have both the testosterone, so that the tumor gets a high dose of testosterone, because testosterone kills breast cancer cells very aggressively. It's an anti-cancer hormone. But the tumor can take the testosterone. Testosterone and estrogen only have one hydroxyl group difference. So they can strip off the hydroxyl group and make it into estrogen. So you use an estrogen blocker just in the breast along with the testosterone. And the few papers that have been done on this have shown that the tumors just shrivel up and get tiny, tiny, tiny instead of growing. So, you know, when I have a woman of which I am desperately in love in my life, my wife, and I think about these things, and I can tell you right now, if she developed a breast cancer, I would be, you know, contacting the doctors that are writing these papers and saying, hey, I want you to consult on my wife, because it's very different from the way it's usually done, but it seems to be very effective, and it doesn't give them all those devastating side effects that the hormonal blockers give.
Yeah.
Is it easy to get a hold of these people?
Well, they are university research types. They are not usually out hanging around in your local tavern waiting to be questioned. But yes, you can reach them. Rebecca Glazier in Ohio, she is no longer seeing patients herself, or at least not very much. I think she sees patients one day a week. She's mostly into research now, but she has several colleagues who are still seeing patients and using her protocols. And then Dr. Donovitz out of, I forget what the name of the medical school is in Atlanta, Meriwether Medical School, that was it. He has also published several papers on this subject. So Rebecca Glazier in Ohio, you can look her up online.
Mm-hmm. Google them up and find out where they are.
And just,
I'll do that. Well, thank you very much for all the information. It's been just amazing.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Bye-bye.
We wish your sister all the best with her journey. We have several callers on the line. Dr. Mixon, are you ready? Let's go to Lacey. We have Eileen here. Good morning, Eileen. How can we help?
Oh, hi. I've got my little ear pods in. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. They're working well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I never know whether to trust them. I called a month ago and spoke with Dr. Umat, and you also, Dr. Mixon, about Evenity, which is the drug for osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
I have it, and that's pretty bad, and I'm at risk, severe risk for a fracture in my left hip. So they wanted to start me on this drug, which is a shot every month for a year. Okay,
right.
You know about it. And in giving me the informed consent, he told me about a very small risk of cardiovascular event and stroke.
Mm-hmm.
In the first study, there was one, and in the subsequent study, there was none. So she doesn't think it's a big issue. Well, Dr. Umat found a different study when we talked on March 23rd, and she said, no, in the first study, it was a 0.2 to 0.3%. We don't know the numbers. Occurrence, and in the second study, it raised to 2.8%.
Yes.
Now, I am being worked up for heart failure right now. I've got all the tests done and everything to figure out why the heck that happened. We don't even know. I'm going to see my provider on Tuesday, and I want to bring this up to him, ask him about Evenity. And if I had somewhere to look for those studies that Dr. Umat found, I would be able to tell him that, and then also the osteoporosis provider when I see her.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. You hear the music, but I will get...
Very good.
But you sit tight, and I'll be right back. And we'll talk a little about Evenity, stroke, heart attacks, osteonecrosis of your jaw, and the other nasty effects, and the reasons this drug is it's only used for people with severe fractures.
Okay.
Severe fracture risk.
Okay. And we're going to talk more about Evenity osteoporosis. And then we've got John and Terry. We're going to get to your calls as well. You're tuned in to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. We're taking a break. We'll be right back. Stay right there. Welcome back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette Morgan, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon. We have Eileen on the phone. We're talking about osteoporosis and all of those different...
Now, for the listeners that don't remember our previous calls with her, this is a lady with significant osteoporosis, and so her doctors have written a drug called Evenity, E-V-E-N-I-T-Y. And this is a medication that is reserved for people with severe risk of a fracture. They've either had a fracture within the last year, or their bones are so thin and so fragile that the doctors are not willing to let them even walk on the streets without an intervention. Because when elderly people over 70 fracture a hip, a significant portion of them spend the rest of their life in the nursing home. And, that's not our goal. And so people that have that kind of high risk, they go on this drug. Now, the reason the drug is reserved for that it works very quickly. You only need about a year to get a significant increase in bone density. It actually makes the bone grow faster, unlike most of these drugs that make it harder but don't really stimulate the bone's growth. The osteoblasts that make new bone go into overdrive, and the osteoclasts that dissolve the bone actually get inhibited. So in many respects, it acts like both an estrogen and an estrogen to slow bone loss and a testosterone to stimulate, an androgen to stimulate bone growth. That part is all good. The downside is the incidence of strokes, heart attacks, congestive failure, kidney failure, hypersensitivity reactions, osteonecrosis, all sorts of bad stuff are significantly higher with this drug than they are with other forms of intervention. And doctors who want to write the drug tend to minimize those risks. Those of us that don't write the drug tend to look at it, I think, a little more even-handedly and say, okay, there are people that really need it. There are people in whom it should be used, but you should be informed about the possible problems. Don't minimize stuff. Okay, here's how you look this up. You go to a website you can get into called PubMed, PubMed.com. This will then forward you to the National Institute of Health database, and you type in either Evenity, EVENITY, space, and then put in complications or adverse reactions, and it will go to, it'll pull up every paper published that uses those things, the trade name Evenity, and the adverse reactions. And you'll probably get more hits if you put in the chemical name of the drug, because that's what most of the research papers will have, is the chemical name, which is R-O-M-O-S-O-Z-U-M-A-B.
Okay.
That's the chemical name. Put in that along with adverse reactions or complications, and the National Institute of Health will pull up all the journal articles published in the last 20 years on this drug. It's a fairly new drug, so probably mostly in the last 10 years. And, you know, you can page through those, print out the ones you want, and take them to your doctor.
Oh, thank you.
All right. And Eileen, let us know. Feel free to call back next week. Yeah. Let us know what you found out or what you decided. And
you know, and if you're one of our patients, then your doctor at Longevity will print those papers out for you. Mm-hmm. But we can't, unfortunately, take the time to do it.
My husband was last year, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. We wish you the best, Eileen.
I really appreciate you guys.
All right. You take care, my dear, and good luck.
Thank you for the call. This is Leading Edge Medicine. On the phone now, we have John. Good morning, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello, John.
Hi. I had heard something about inhalation anesthesia.
Uh-huh.
And my brother heard about it. It could be a problem with thinking afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And some kind of medical reference that I could refer my doctor to who hasn't heard about this.
I see.
Also, acetylcholine and think factor. There's something, I don't know if those are the same thing, but those two things I'm interested in. And what I'm going to try to do is record your intro on my my little recorder while you're talking.
Okay. Well, I'm going to refer you to the
just for a second. Hold on.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
All right. Are we on?
Okay. I'm recording.
Okay. Well, first of all, inhalation anesthesia that takes people very deep does correlate with a drop in IQ. But it's usually not just the anesthesia. It's usually people that are having serious problems that have to go on the external ventilation pumps, but also things like the circulatory pumps. Say that you're having coronary bypass surgery and they need to stop your heart. You know, the anesthesiologist will be breathing for you. They put you on the heart lung pump, and the machine is now circulating your blood, etc. That sort of very deep, deep anesthesia that takes you way down low was the first ones we were noticing that had a significant drop in IQ afterwards. And so it turns out that older people, and of course, old people are the ones who usually end up with the most surgeries. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just because of our age, we live longer, more stuff has time to go wrong. So older people with fragile brains and already have poor circulation to our brains who get very, very deep, long-lasting anesthesia very definitely result in cognitive decline afterwards. And sometimes it recovers over time and sometimes it doesn't. So my general rule is when you're over about 65 or 70, you should be cautious. You want anesthesia that will take you as deep as necessary to do the job. We don't want you moving on the operating table or waking up, but we don't want you taking any deeper than you really need to be. And if there is a practical possibility to use regional anesthesia or regional with enhanced local on top of it, or spinal anesthesia or paracervical blocks or something, I prefer those. On those occasions, I've had to have some surgery, like when I broke my hip glacier skiing, or when I had the screws taken out, or I had a little device put between some of my spinal processes to get rid of some back pain I had. I had that done under local anesthesia with just mild sedation so that I got drowsy and relaxed, but I didn't have deep anesthesia because I'm 76 years old and I make my living with my brain and I'd like to keep it. Thank you very much.
Yes.
So I want as little insult to my brain as practical. On the other hand, I recognize that I do not want to be, you know, wide awake like, you know, 200 years ago and have somebody give me a piece of leather to bite on while they cut me open wide awake. This is not acceptable either.
I think they give you a shot of whiskey, too, maybe.
Something like that. So, you know, life is a series of trade-offs. Mm. And what you want to do is to provide as much protection for our aging brain as we can, while still getting the benefits of modern medical interventions. And so, you know, trade-offs. Most anesthesiologists are well aware of this risk, and although I'm not sure how many surgeons even pay attention to it, because their job is the surgery, the anesthesia is the anesthesiologist's job. The surgery goes well and you wake up and you don't bleed and you don't die and whatever problem he's operating is fixed, he considers it a success.
Yes.
And if your IQ dropped 10 points, not his problem.
Good to be aware.
Yeah. You know, the journal articles, if people want to read the journal, you know, the good site that I just told the last lady about, mm-hmm. PubMed, it's maintained by the National Institute of Health, is PubMed.com, and it'll take you to the National Institute of Health database, and you can put in whatever search words you want. You know, anesthesia and cognition would be a good combination here. And all the papers written in the last 20 years that have those concepts in them will pop up, and you can read the abstracts. And if you want to buy the papers themselves, they're usually $50, $60 a paper, but you can buy the papers and have access to them. Some papers are public access. You don't have to pay anything for, but most of them, the people publishing the papers want to get paid. So that's what I tell you. You can pull up the papers and show them to your doctors. But generally, my observation is if you talk to your anesthesiologist, tell your anesthesiologist about your concerns and tell them you want to be carried as lightly as possible. You want to be as well oxygenated as possible because you have heard about this and you want to be cautious. I disapprove of it when you meet your anesthesiologist 3 minutes before you go in the operating room and everything else is done by the nurse. On those occasions that I have required some sort of operative intervention, I insist on meeting with my anesthesiologist in advance, and I tell them exactly what I will and will not accept in the way of anesthesia. and we work out a plan together in advance. Of course, I have the advantage. I'm also an MD, and I'm a little pushy. So, but it's my body, and I'm in charge of it. That's just all there is to it. I hope that helps.
Yeah, I hope that helps you, John.
Well, that does, and I heard about acetylcholine. Is that the only one that can give problems, or are there others also?
Oh, there's a lot of ways to, for your brain to go wrong.
No. Well, thank you.
There's always more ways to do something wrong than there are to do it right.
Yeah, I mean, why is that?
The real world. There's a lot of ways for our brains to go wrong. And, you know, the most common ones are things like vascular disease, the same things that cause the blood vessels to clog up in our hearts and in our extremities and our legs and stuff that give us numb toes. They also happen in our brains. It's one circulatory system. And so you start cutting down the blood supply to your brain, you're going to have, you know, more thinking problems, higher risk of dementia. Trauma to the brain, you know, if you've ever had head injuries, auto accidents, concussions, those increase your risk of dementia significantly.
Well, I'm thinking about hand surgery. So is there a recommended
Hand surgery is almost always under regional and local. They'll usually, if it's your hand, they'll usually do something like a brachial plexus block so that just your hand and arm go numb, and that shouldn't affect your cognition at all.
Okay. Well, that's a big relief. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, take care, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, John. We are taking a quick break. We're back with you, Terry and Hilmer. We're going to take your question and talk to Daniel in just a few moments. Stay right there. This is Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. We'll be back.
Makes it easy to impress 12-year-olds.
Yes, there you go. We're back. Hi there. Good morning. Enjoying the day. Dr. Jerry Mixon here in the studio.
I am indeed.
Dr. UMAT has the weekend off. A lot of calls. We're just going to dive into the next one here from Mount Lake Terrace. Terry is on the line. Welcome, Terry.
Hey, hello, Terry. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. And my question is for your reaction to something that my primary told me.
Okay.
A while back, I went in for a battery of tests. I'm looking at my own hypothyroidism and other, you know, high cholesterol issues. But
sure.
On the list, I went in with my list, and on the list, of course, is the usual fasting glucose, fasting insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told they couldn't do the fasting insulin because there was no science, and they couldn't interpret it. What's your reaction to that?
Bull Bucky.
Because this is a family show.
That's right.
That was my reaction, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, insulin testing is very simple, usually about $30 a pop. And it's not there's no science. It's that your doctor doesn't know the science. There's the problem. So, you know, people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of a medical student. You know, when I was an ignorant young medical student and somebody asked me a question I didn't know the answer to, my fallback was, well, I don't know. Does anybody know? And it turned out usually the professor did know. So I learned not to say that. Yeah, the fact is that your fasting insulin, to some degree, is at least an indirect indicator of the amount of insulin resistance you are having. If your fasting insulin is down around 2 or 3, and your hemoglobin A1C is down at, you know, 5.0, 5.2, 5.3, that tells me that you have no insulin resistance. You don't have to have much insulin to, you know, to lower your sugar. If your fasting insulin is up around 20 or 25,
wow,
you know, and your A1C is up there at 4 or 4.5 or 5.5, now I'm more concerned about you because you're putting out a lot of insulin even in a fasting state, and your sugars are higher than my, you know, than my goals. So that tells me, yeah, this is a guy who's really got significant insulin resistance for some reason. So, you know, we use a fasting insulin paired with a fasting glucose to tell us how much insulin it's taking to keep your sugar in a given range. Now, in our clinic, we also frequently do a paired 30-minute glucose challenge with insulin. In other words, we give you 75 grams of glucose. 30 minutes later, we check your sugar and your insulin, and because we want to see how high your sugar will go and how much insulin you are producing in response to that. That then tells me, you know, what your pancreatic function is like and how well you can respond to a glucose challenge. So having both fasting and challenged insulins and fasting and challenged glucose put together with an A1C gives us a pretty good picture of your glucose and insulin metabolism.
Sure. Well, my reaction was that, so hypothetically, let's say your glucose was 80 and your insulin was under 4. You can't tell the difference between that and if, let's say, insulin was over 40. And I also said, as far as interpretation goes, leave that to me.
Yeah, all right. Yes. But if your fasting glucose is 80, you're okay. It tells me that whatever your insulin resistance is, you are at least driving your sugars down by morning. But sure. I don't know how fast you're bringing them, and I don't know how steep your curve is. And that's why I also like to put that together with an A1C and a insulin challenge or a glucose challenge.
I get that. And I didn't go that far with the person. I just said, leave it to me. But so the response was they would run they would run the other test, but I would have to go to someone else to get the fasting insulin. And I thought that was just unacceptable.
Yes, it is. Well, you know, there's a little adage I've put out many times over the years. I'm going to repeat it, even at the risk of boring those of you who have heard it. In the Naval Academy, the bottom person who graduates in the class of the Naval Academy is called the anchor. In the Annapolis, the Army Academy, the bottom person in the class of graduations is called the goat. In medical school, the person who graduates in the bottom of the class is called doctor, just like the guy at the top of the class. And so, you know.
Yeah.
And goat, I'm thinking, is not greatest of all time. It's a different kind of
goat. That's right. You got it. Yeah. So,
well, because everything else I'm interested in for thyroid function and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. they'll do those. But, And they'll send the referral for the cholesterol stuff over to Quest for their cardio IQ, and that's the only one I'm interested in for cholesterol. Okay. But sure. As you know, thyroid and cholesterol levels are related.
Of course, so, they're related.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Good
luck,
Terry.
Finding a doctor who knows more than you do. So
there we go. Oh, Leading Edge Medicine continues taking the phone calls this morning, 800-465-8770. We are not going too far. Redmond, we have Hilmer on the phone. Good morning, Hilmer.
Hello, Hilmer.
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're good.
Hilmer, you know that if the scoundrels in charge find out how good I feel,
they'll tax it.
Absolutely. So,
let's avoid that. So, anyway.
Yes.
So just me, you, and a few thousand of our closest friends.
That's right.
Know that I feel great.
There you go. Hey, I was just wondering, I'm very, on rapamycin. You know quite a bit about it, and you're taking it yourself, and I was kind of wondering. As far as the dose is concerned, you tend to push the envelope sometimes, the recommended has been between 5 and 7 milligrams once a week. I'm just curious, right. What are you up to, 14 or 21? Or?
Well, let's see. This week, I think I took 17. So,
really?
Yeah.
Does Dr. Umat, your doctor, know this, Dr. Mixon?
She knows it and she disapproves.
Yes, she does.
But says, I signed her paycheck.
That's right.
The reality is, you know, I tend to push the envelope in most aspects of my life. Some of us are by nature risk takers. And, you know, as I pointed out, how I treat my patients and how I treat me is sometimes different, because if I do something stupid and hurt me, I won't sue me. If I do something stupid and hurt you, I'm in trouble. So,
So I'm just wondering. Of course, I know you're heavy. You're tall and so you weigh quite a bit and.
196 pounds.
I give my dogs rapamycin now. So, they recommend 1 milligram per 22 pounds, 3 times a week for the dog. But I'm running the numbers on me. Well, so I'm 180, and so I'm taking 6 milligrams a week, and I'm just wondering. Why are you pushing the envelope? Do you notice any noticeable difference in how you feel, or
yes?
What? Okay.
Yeah, but in my case, that's mostly subjective. But you know, I'm a 76-year-old man with a 76-year-old prostate, and one of the things that I notice most dramatically with me is that if I keep my rapamycin dose is higher than is generally done, I tend to pee a whole lot better. You know, I empty my bladder with alacrity, and I would like to avoid prostate surgery because I have a somewhat more active romantic life than many people, and I do not want my erectile function disturbed by some sort of surgical misadventure. All right.
Right.
So
as far as that is concerned, I had the prostatic artery embolization done 3 months ago at the University of Washington, and so I'm going in for, they're going to do another MRI in July. Is that the 6 month mark? And then I guess do an evaluation. I mean, so far it's working really day by day, week by week. It's better. The symptoms and all that stuff gets better. It's getting better and better, and it continues for up to 6 months, and the improvements and maybe even beyond that is what the doctor says. But so then I'm taking 6 milligrams of rapamycin once a week, and I'm thinking. So I'm listening to you now, and I'm going, maybe I should take more.
Well, I'm not going to recommend that, Hilbert.
No, I know that you can't officially recommend that, but you're also saying that, hell, don't do that, but, you know.
Like I said, I have a different lifestyle than 99.9% of the human race, right?
And you also keep it very monitored. You monitor yourself,
yes,
and your doctor does.
Tell you what, we've got a break coming up. You hear the music, so... When we come back, we'll chat a little bit more about responsibility for your own life, all right?
All right.
Sounds good.
This is Leading Edge Medicine. Hilmer, you stay right there. We're going to get back with Daniel. We're going to talk about NAD and REM in this next half hour. Stay with us. That's right. Leading Edge Medicine continues hour number 2 on the way. Stay right there.